and guests, and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Midcoast Radio Project, or its staff and volunteers.
This is The 10th Voice, Kansas City's gay and lesbian radio magazine. The 10th Voice, because you refuse to be silent.
Hello, KKFI listeners. This is Sandra Mead here with the 10th Voice. This is the Trans Talk edition of the 10th Voice. We do Trans Talk on the fourth Saturday of every month. And behind the board today, Linda is taking a day off. Diana Lynn is filling in. So, Diana, thank you very much for filling in for Linda. It's going to be a pleasure. We're going to have a great show.
Let's go.
Our first interview guest today is going to be Monica Roberts. She's an award-winning trans community leader that has lobbied since 1998 for trans human rights protections at the federal, state, and local levels in Kentucky and Kansas. We'll discuss the long history of trans people of color in the LGBT rights movement, the seeming erasure and minimization of their contributions to said history, and the disparate challenges faced by trans people of color today. Next up after Monica's interview, we'll be talking with Justin Shaw. He's the Executive Director of the Kansas City Anti-Violence Project, known as KCAVP, and we'll be talking about the important mission serving the entire LGBT community in the Kansas City metro area. Awareness about violence against trans people, especially trans people of color, is heightened at this time of year as the transgender community prepares for another Transgender Day of Remembrance coming up on November 20th. So that's going to be a pretty important discussion that you'll want to listen into. And, of course, at the end of the show, Brent Husher will round out the show with a community calendar update. But first, let's give you a breakdown of the news this week, the LGBT news. As always, there's too much noise going on to fit everything in each week, but here's a rundown of some of the stories. Out of Russia, a 22-year-old transgender woman committed suicide after losing her job because of President Putin's anti-gay laws. Dasha Stern had been living with friends after being thrown out of her house by her parents and was working for the Yekaterinburg government in Shverdlovsk. I totally messed that up. Central Russia. She had recently bought a car and had just been given a mortgage so she could buy her own apartment when Stern's bosses fired her, fearing that continuing to employ her would break gay propaganda laws. No longer able to afford the payments on her car or mortgage, she killed herself. Top lawyer and trans rights activist Masha Best told Gay Star News that Dasha is a victim of Putin's laws and she's a victim of the indifference in Russian society. In Great Britain, a British member of Parliament will introduce a bill to ban gay care therapists this week. Geraint Davies, a Labour MP from Swansea West, has called for nationwide regulation of mental health therapists to ensure that any gay teen or adult is not faced with quack treatment. He said that in Britain, anyone can set themselves up as a counselor or psychotherapist without training or experience, with no recourse for the patient if something goes wrong. I call on the government to regulate counselors and psychotherapists by bringing them into the jurisdiction of the Health and Care Professionals Council. If accepted, the bill would mean to work as a psychotherapist or counselor. You must need the necessary standards of qualifications and experience, he said. The measure has cross-party support. In Oklahoma City, despite Oklahoma's ban on gay marriage, Darren Blackbear and his partner of 9 years, Jason Pickle, plan to walk each other down the aisle on October 31st, becoming the first state same-sex married couple in that state. They will be able to do that because Black Bear is a member of the Cheyenne Arapaho tribe in Oklahoma, which is among the few Native American tribes in the U.S. that allow same-sex marriage. Like all federally recognized tribes, the Cheyenne Arapaho can approve laws for its land and its members. Its marriage code doesn't address gender, referring to the parties simply as Indians. Black Bear and Pickle won't be awarded state benefits given to married couples in Oklahoma, but they will receive federal marriage benefits, and they said a primary reason they decided to marry was to enable Pickle to be added to Black Bear's health insurance. And this is kind of related to Halloween for all of you, those of you who are out there buying candy for the little kids that are going to be coming around trick-or-treating. The chairman of the Jelly Belly Candy Company is among those trying to block a new California law that protects transgender students from going into effect. Herman Rowland Sr., chair of the California-based company, has donated $5,000 to the organization called Privacy for All Students. That they have a campaign going that's trying to gather enough signatures to qualify for a ballot measure to repeal the School Success and Opportunity Act passed earlier this year, which allows transgender students to have access to school facilities that match their gender identity. That's scheduled to go into effect on January 1st. In Pennsylvania, Grove City College professor of political science Paul Kanger says that allowing same-sex couples to marry is part of a nefarious conspiracy to end the family unit, in line with Marxist thinking. In an opinion piece for the far-right news website WND, Kanger says economically conservative gay people who support same-sex or economically conservative people who support same-sex marriage have enlisted in the radical left's unyielding centuries-old attempt to undermine the family. The left, in the West generally, and America specifically, he said, has found its hammer and sickle to smash and undercut marriage. In Louisville, Kentucky, United Way of Bluegrass, based in Lexington, Kentucky, has cut off nearly $100,000 in annual funding to a regional scouting council in response to the Boy Scouts of America's policy which bans gay scout leaders. The United Way chapter was the biggest single contributor to the Boy Scouts Bluegrass, to the Boy Scouts Bluegrass Council until the funding was suspended this month. We're hoping that the Boy Scouts can resolve this issue because we would love to continue to fund them, Bill Farmer, president of the United Way chapter, said in an interview. Our policy is if an organization is not in compliance, we will suspend funding until they are. Los Angeles, California, on Wednesday, police arrested a second person in connection with the beating of a transgender woman on Hollywood Boulevard. The May 31st attack was captured on a surveillance camera showing the victim, known as Vivian, being kicked while on the ground by four males. Police had been keeping an eye on this particular suspect throughout the investigation, according to Los Angeles police officer Drake Madison. After watching the man for a couple of months, police have found enough evidence to arrest him, but the man's name has not been immediately released. In El Monte, California, a transgender woman has filed a federal lawsuit against the city of El Monte and an unnamed police officer, claiming that the police officer detained her without legal cause and raped her in a dark, empty parking lot. El Monte Police Chief Steve Schuster told NBC4 in Los Angeles that an officer had been placed on leave while the El Monte Police Department conducts an internal investigation and the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department conducts a criminal investigation. The plaintiff claims that after ordering her to perform oral sex on him, the officer raped her on the hood of his patrol car and then dropped his condom on the ground before ordering her to leave. She returned later and retrieved the condom as evidence, which has now been handed over to the Los Angeles County Sheriff. And LGBTQ Nation reported earlier this week that the religious right, talking about the religious right in this one particular organization, Pacific Justice Institute, they've been promoting claims made about a transgender student in Colorado High School that said that she had been supposedly harassing other girls in the locker room and restrooms. In reality, subsequent investigation found that there was no harassment, and the entire story boils down to the fact that PJI considers the mere presence of a transgender girl to be inherently intimidating and harassing. Even though PGAI has been thoroughly discredited this week thanks to the investigation done by Kristen Williams at thetransadvocate.com, a conservative anti-gay chaplain nevertheless doubled down this week anyway. Dr. Chaps Gordon Klingenschmidt discussed the topic on his program called Pray in Jesus' Name, claiming she is possessed by a demonic spirit, and said that she is raping, at least visually, these girls simply by sharing a locker room with them. And that's pretty much a wrap of our LGBT news today. Up next, we've got an interview with Monica Roberts. I'm going to tell you a little bit about her. Monica's been extremely engaged for quite some time. She's a native Houstonian and a trailblazing, award-winning trans community leader, and that's no joke. She's lobbied since 1998 for trans human rights protection at the federal, state, and local levels in Kentucky and Texas. In 2006, she became the third African-American trans person and the first African-American Texan to be given the IFGE Trinity Award, the transgender community's highest meritorious service award. She was named to the inaugural Trans 100 list and honored with the Monica Roberts Advocacy Award by Black Trans Men Incorporated in March of 2013. Monica was a founding member of NTAC, the National Transgender Advocacy Coalition, and served on its inaugural board as its policy director from 1999 to 2002. She served on the boards of Louisville, Kentucky's Fairness Campaign and CFAIR, helped organize the 2005 and 2006 Trans Sistas and Trans Brothers conferences that took place in Louisville, and participated in the first ever trans-themed panel discussions at Netroots Nations and Out on the Hill in 2012. In addition to participating in this long list of panel discussions, town halls, and keynote speaking engagements to various colleges, groups, and conferences over the years, in January 2006, she founded the award-winning blog TransGriot. Monica's going to help me remember how to pronounce that correctly. But that's really how I came to know about Monica, and I've been following her blog. It's been really interesting. She writes about trans issues from an Afrocentric perspective, and has appeared in Ebony.com, Loop21.com, TransAdvocate, The Huffington Post, Racialist, Feminista, Global Comment, The Bill Orico Project, Elixir, What Tammy Said, and Womanist Musings. That is a lot of stuff. That's quite a bio. Monica, thank you very much for joining us today on KKFI.
And thanks for the invite, Sandra.
That's wonderful. I've enjoyed reading your blog, TransGriot, for some time. Can you tell us how we pronounce that?
It's Griot, actually. And basically, I got the name because I come from a family of historians. And griots in several West African nations are oral historians who can recite up to 5 centuries of their people's history from memory.
Oh, wow.
And so when I was looking for a name to, call the blog, and I wanted it kind of to reflect my culture on top of that, it was perfect for it. It seemed like it was perfect for it. So I've been the trans griot ever since.
Well, that's great. I promise I'm not going to ask you to recite 5 centuries of history from the top of your head. I promise I won't do that to you.
No, I would need more than 30. I would need more than 30 minutes for that.
Very true. What I've really enjoyed about your blog is obviously I am awash in white privilege. As a trans woman, I experience the discrimination and the bias that comes along with that. But I can't, I can't speak to the experience that you have. And obviously, the trans women of color and trans men of color face an additional barrier above and beyond what the majority of the rest of us do. And you speak about that a lot in your blog. And I want to thank you for educating me and the rest of the community that's really interested in learning more about, other elements of our community. I think it's extremely important. And you speak a lot about the history of trans women of color and their legacy of advocacy in the LGBT community. Share a little bit of that with us. Talk to us a little bit about before Stonewall. And we'll probably take a break after that and talk about Stonewall and beyond. But is there any history that you can share with us prior to Stonewall or leading up to Stonewall?
Yeah, actually, one of the first events that happened before Stonewall, in addition to the Cooper's Donuts riots in Los Angeles in 1959, and the one at Compton's Cafeteria, there was one which was predominantly done by African American gender variant folks at Dewey's Lunch Counter in Philadelphia in April of 1965. What happened was it was a hangout for, you know, for African American gender variant people because it was sitting between two gay clubs in Philadelphia. And the owners, because they were, you know, the cisgender owners were worried about how much of an effect all these kids, gender variant kids, would have on their business, basically set down the edict that they would not serve anyone in gender nonconforming clothing. And so, of course, this being the 60s and the civil rights movement being very active, they borrowed the tools and the models of the civil rights movement and did their own protest. They sit-in protest until the owners basically changed their tune on that.
That is fascinating. And the owners were okay with the gay and lesbian clientele, obviously, probably got a lot of business from that, but they were not okay with the trans variety.
No.
Very interesting.
Yeah, it was kind of interesting because it was one of the first protests actually that focused on issues of, that you could say that was actually a trans issue themed protest.
Interesting. Hey, Monica, hang on for just a second. I've got some more questions about that and Stonewall coming up right after. We've got a sponsor announcement. We'll be right back.
Okay.
This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Chris Christie surrenders in the battle for New Jersey marriage equality. Tret Fury carves herself a piece of the sky. And love looks for a way out in the dark. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
This Way Out airs 2 p.m. Saturdays, right after the 10th Voice.
Funding for KKFI provided by the Weekly Forum at All Souls UU Church. Each Sunday at 10 a.m., the forum will feature a discussion on community issues. All Souls UU Church is at 4501 Walnut Street, one block east of Main in Kansas City. More information is at allsoulskc.org.
Groove to Amend, a concert to support KC Move to Amend, this Saturday from 6 to midnight at the Uptown Arts Bar. More information at kcmovetoamend.org. This message is a public service of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
And we're back. We're back with Monica Roberts. Monica, let's talk a little bit about Stonewall. I know that the trans women of color had a big part of the history of kicking off Stonewall, I believe. But I don't know that that's necessarily seen or well depicted in necessarily some of the historical documents and documentaries about the Stonewall. Tell us about the women you know who participated in Stonewall and kind of how that all kicked off and what their participation was in Stonewall.
Well, I say it's pretty much known over the last few years that Sylvia Rivera was one of the people that kicked it off. And Marsha P. Johnson, you know, her role has also, as Sylvia's right hand, has in the movement subsequent to, you know, where they went politically after Stonewall, you know, has been documented a bit. But one of the other people whose role is starting to emerge is Miss Major Griffin Gracie. And who had a birthday yesterday, by the way.
Happy birthday, Miss Major.
Yeah, Miss Major, yeah. And hopefully this documentary that's coming out will shed a lot, that is being compiled, will shed a lot more light on Miss Major's role in that. And she also had the interesting, backdrop of being at Attica, you know, being incarcerated at Attica when they had that seminal riot too. So, you know, she's been, you know, say she's one of the few people that's been around at two historical event. So,
well, I'm thankful that she's still with us so we can get that historical perspective from her. Now, I know that, some documentation and documentaries have been done, I think, about Sylvia Rivera, and she's passed now. But yeah. I'm glad to hear that Miss Major, and I assume Marsha Johnson, she's still with us as well?
Unfortunately, Marsha was found as a dead after a pride parade in the 90s. Under mysterious circumstances, the New York police closed the investigation at the time, claiming that Marsha committed suicide. And that case just got reopened a few months ago. The investigation in that just got reopened a few months ago. I did have the pleasure of meeting Sylvia in May of 2000 and had a nice long conversation with her about a lot of the stuff that she dealt with. And one of the messages that she gave me was to kind of keep a close eye on HRC because she's never trusted HRC. And we actually, let's say that night, I had the long conversation with her. We were even arguing about LBJ, and I had to tell her, I said, look, Sylvia, I grew up in Texas where we actually named high schools and his library is a presidential library is home too, so we'll have to agree to disagree on that one. But it was, I didn't realize the significance of me talking to the mother of the the trans rights movement until she passed away a few years later.
Yes.
And you know, saying it was one of those times where I was like, darn, I wish I'd had a tape recorder at that point.
But That's really too sad.
She was literally on her deathbed still advocating for the trans community when they were, she was trying to get when gender was being passed and we got cut out of it. She was fighting on her deathbed trying to get us, get us included in that bill in New York State.
Okay.
And, we're still fighting to get included in it a decade later.
Yeah, exactly. Agenda. And it's going to be interesting to see what happens with ENDA, if anything happens with ENDA anytime soon.
From where I sit and realistically, I don't see any movement happening on ENDA until we get a Democratic majority in the House.
And we can hope for that. We can certainly hope for that in 2014, right? I certainly can't tell any of the listeners who they should vote for, but some of us can hope for a friendly environment in 2014, I think.
Because I don't see this Republican control. I don't see a Republican controlled Congress, especially with a lot of Tea Party members who are anti-civil rights voting to pass it.
Very true.
Especially in the way that their districts have been gerrymandered and stuff as a result of the 2010 election.
Yeah, because there's a lot of candidates, a lot of politicians that don't have to worry about about being primaried as long as they stay as conservative and as bigot as they can possibly be. They're locked into their seat. I want to talk to you about a couple other things. I've been learning a lot from reading you and reading other various articles and whatnot. And I read periodically about trans identity erasure and the whitewashing, essentially, of LGBT history in the past that got us here. What do you think about that? Have the contributions of trans people in the LGBT movement and especially trans women of color, have they been erased or whitewashed? What's your take on that? And popular
a lot
LGBT
of it has
culture.
Been. A combination of factors play into that. The old Harry Benjamin WPATH standards are part of that. Where before the 90s when they relaxed them, trans people were advised to transition, hide, don't let anybody know about our status. And even move away from your your home areas where you grew up and never let anybody know. Well, that makes it hard for you to build community if you don't know that you know, say you're living next door to somebody that that is trans, or, you know, say maybe working with somebody who's trans, or much less even documenting the history.
It certainly is. That mm-hmm. kind of runs counter to what a lot of us are saying now about the need for visibility.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly understand the need for many people to be stealth, and if they do that and that's their choice, I certainly applaud them. That's their right. But we need as many as possible to be out and visible, certainly.
And I'm one of those folks that have argued, and you've probably seen some of the posts on the blog where I argued that stealth was a mistake.
Yes, yes.
And I say that because, you know, one of the community building aspect of it, and it also denied us the opportunity to not only build community in a more politically friendly environment, it also denied us the opportunity to get politically organized and also pass the legislation that we need in a more politically friendly climate, you know, that was amenable to civil rights, instead of having to, you know, to pretty much ice skate uphill trying to get it passed with conservative leaning governments. You know, we've done a remarkable job over the last, you know, since the 90s.
Yes, we have.
Considering the opposition that we've had, but, you know, it's my belief that had we been able to do so in the 60s instead of having to start in the 90s, you know, there would be a lot different landscape. There would be a different landscape.
I agree 100%. I can definitely see that. And now we're in such a polarized landscape now.
Politically, yes.
It's crazy, and it's yeah. really hard to get done. And, you know, some of the news stories I just gave even speak to that, just the vitriol that is coming up now, and how the trans community has kind of been picked up as the new rallying cry for the conservative community to stop the gay rights movement, and it's really, really
just
terrible.
Yeah, just as they fail to stop, you know, the African-American community in their civil rights march, just as they have failed now to stop the gay and lesbian community, they will fail in this one.
Yes.
Because, you know, as Dr. King and others have said, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. And Lord knows trans people need the justice.
Yes.
Needed to see it bending toward justice, and especially trans people of color. You know, where we're literally catching hell. You know, in terms of the front, you know, being the front line, you know, foot soldiers that are catching a lot of the anti-trans violence. We're catching a lot of the, you know, the bulk of the discrimination in terms of, in some cases, 26% unemployment rates. In a lot of, you know, which is double the 15%, almost double the 15% that trans people on average face.
That is so shameful. As a humanity, as a human species, that
mm-hmm.
is just so shameful that we target and ostracize a segment of humanity like that.
Yeah, the problem is, you know, as trans people of color, we get it. You know, we can never escape the fact that, you know, we're hated because of our skin color. And
correct.
Then you layer on trans issues on top of that. So you're getting another extra layer of discrimination and bigotry heaped upon you on top of that. Plus the violation of the gender, you know, of the gender binary that also fuels some of this violence and ostracism, combined with, you know, patchworks of laws and stuff where, you know, the law hasn't caught up with, you know, with the realities of our lives fast enough.
That's correct. And you take that compounding and you compound that with, on last month's show, I talked with Andrea James and Dr. Daryl Ray, and we talked about
mm-hmm.
guilt and shame. And, you know, the policing of masculinity and the policing of femininity in our culture, and how that compounds. Men have so much guilt, and they take that guilt, and especially as it relates to trans people and trans women of color, And that's largely why we see such horrific statistics with Transgender Day of Remembrance every year. Transgender Day of Remembrance is something we're going to be talking about later in the show with my next guest. And largely, the majority of the participants in that are transgender women of color.
Yeah. I saw the statistics on that. It's about 70% of the Remembering Our Dead list ever since Gwen Smith and Ethan St. Pierre and that has started compiling that list. About 70% of that list is of people of color.
I believe it. I believe it. Last year at TDOR, I was one of the folks that helped coordinate it, and we're doing the same thing. We've got a little board that we put together, and we're coordinating TDOR again this year. And it's terrible. The viciousness with which these victims are killed speaks highly of the vitriol and just to the degree to which, you know, our community is disparaged.
And we really, you know, been hit hard in the African American trans feminine community, where, you know, we've had 2 months this year back in April, and once again in August, where we had three, you know, trans women killed within days of each other.
Yes, I was reporting on them. It was
terrible.
The
other part that really bothers me about that is all of those women who were killed were under 35.
What a shame.
We're under age 35.
A whole life ahead of them that they're not going to have an opportunity to experience.
I say you probably saw the post that I wrote where I say, which was close to my own birthday, my 51st birthday when I wrote it. I'm like, will my trans sisters even live to see 40?
I remember
or
that.
30, much less get to my age or Miss Major's age or, you know, Cheryl Courtney Evans' age, or much less, you know, the kids that are sitting, you know, in elementary, middle school, and high school, you know, will they have elders to look up to? Like, you know, it's like, yeah, it's a state of emergency, as Janet Mock, you know, and I have talked about it, and we say, you know, we're literally under a state of emergency in the black and Latina trans community.
That's a great way to put it.
You know, let's say in terms of this level of violence that we're experiencing.
That's a great way to put it,
Monica. Before we even go off of United States shores and start looking at Brazil.
Yeah.
And start looking at Turkey. And I fear that because of the anti-gay and trans laws that are popping up in Russia, you know, that you referenced in the run up before I came on, that's going to eventually spike deaths in Russia too, Russia and Eastern Europe too.
Yes. Eastern Europe and Russia, what Russia's doing is just absolutely horrific. Monica, I've got one more question real quick that I need to ask you, and then I've got to move on to my second guest. But from your take, you know, what would your recommendation be for I heard this term, gay for pay, from a friend of mine just a couple days ago. What would you recommend for the big gay for pay organizations and other grassroots organizers as well? What should they be doing differently to address the needs of the most marginalized LGBT community, the trans brothers and sisters? What are they doing that they should do differently?
Very simply, hire qualified trans people of color for these organizations, and especially trans women of color. I love Kyla Broadus to death, but, you know, usually any time that I see Gay Inc. organizations hiring people, it's usually trans men.
Yes.
It is rare that you will see them hire a trans woman, much less a trans woman to run their organizations. A lot of what happened and with the collapse of OutServe SLDN when Allison Robinson was running it, was the big, you know, say, was some residual bigotry, you know, in the GL ranks. in terms of having Allison as the helm at the helm of that organization.
Right. Right.
Yeah. And but yeah, if you're going to, you know, say that you are an ally to this community, and you know that we have these horrific unemployment rates, well, it would say, it would speak volumes if you actually did some hiring of, you know, of trans people yourself.
Correct. Correct.
Yeah. You know, to That's... send a message, you know, to, you know, because you're sending a message, whether you believe it or not, by not hiring us.
Absolutely correct. That's mm-hmm. right. Monica, thank you very much for that. Unfortunately, we're out of time and I have to move on. So I want to thank you very much for being on the show today, and I hope you'd be willing to come back on the show again. I'd love to continue having this conversation with you.
I'll be happy to.
Very okay. good. Thank you, Monica, for joining. Listeners, stay tuned. We're going to be up next after this music break. We're going to be up with Justin Shaw from Kansas City Anti-Violence Project, so stay tuned. We're back. We're with Justin Shaw from Kansas City Anti-Violence Project. Justin has worked in the nonprofit sector for more than 10 years, and for more than a year, he's been the executive director at KCAVP. He serves on or leads many local, regional, and national task forces, committees, work groups, and coalitions, actively pursuing social change for the LGBTQ people. Previously, Justin worked at the Unicorn Theater in marketing, fundraising, and literary development. He holds a bachelor's degree from Park University in marketing and management and hopes to pursue a master's in social work degree in 2014 with a clinical focus on LGBTQ families and relationships. Justin is a native of Kansas City. He grew up gay in Raytown, and he actually survived.
I did. And thrived a little, maybe even, which is not always what people think in Raytown.
Welcome to KKFI,
Thank
Justin.
You so much. I'm so honored to be here with you today.
So KCAVP, obviously a very important mission. Tell us a little bit about KCAVP's mission.
Absolutely. KCAVP is celebrating our 10th anniversary this year. So for a small LGBT-focused organization, that's amazing all in itself. And what we do is we serve the LGBT community, victims of violence, particularly domestic and sexual violence and bias crimes and dating violence and stalking and hate crimes, things like that, bullying. We work with youth and adults. We provide direct services to them, including crisis counseling. We have a 24-hour helpline. We also can provide free therapy for victims of violence, legal and medical advocacy, helping to report to the police if that's what the victim chooses to do. We also have a very extensive outreach and education program, which is kind of our social change aspect of our organization. They go out and they train each year thousands of medical professionals and different service providers, teachers, police, and youth, and the community at large about LGBT violence and what it is, how it's perpetuated, and how, if we make social change, we can hopefully prevent it. And so they're very busy all over the city and all over our whole service area, which we were founded to be primarily in the Kansas City metro area because there was a huge need for it here.
That's what I was wondering. Geographically, yeah. Are you just Kansas City and just Kansas City, or how extensive does your services expand into outer areas?
Sure, we've expanded statewide in Missouri and Kansas because there's not any other organizations that are doing LGBT specific anti-violence work. There is occasionally a program or a person that will pop up in St. Louis to do some work, which is really great because there's so much work to be done statewide that if there's somebody in another major metropolitan city to work with clients there and to do education, that's always very helpful. But in Kansas, there's not anybody. And in Iowa and Nebraska, it's very, very limited. We kind of serve all four states in a sense. We are a technical assistance provider, which means that we help mainstream organizations, domestic violence and sexual assault organizations, prepare to serve and to properly serve LGBT victims of violence. And so because there's not really another program around in this four-state area, we are sometimes called to provide that assistance into Iowa and Nebraska as well. So it's a big region all for our little bitty staff.
Oh, that is huge. Yeah. From a violence statistics perspective, how does the violence kind of break down in the LGBT community? Is it primarily domestic violence, gay on gay kind of violence, or is it primarily externally directed sexual assaults, hate crimes? What is it that you guys kind of face?
Sure. Well, the numbers that we look at are what we call incident numbers that are reported. So that's only the numbers of people that are actually reporting, as opposed to the incidents that actually happened throughout the community. We know that a lot of LGBT people do not report enough to our organization and let alone police and things like that because of so many different cross-sections of oppression and homophobia and transphobia that's happened historically. But what we see the most at KCAVP is we're about 40% domestic violence and about 25%, these numbers aren't going to add up to 100, I just see it coming,
sure.
But about 25% of our work is with hate crimes. And then sexual assault is actually really, really underreported, and it usually only comes in at about 12 to 15%. And we know that from working in the community and hearing stories from people in the community that sexual violence is rampant, and people do not report that at all. And it shows us that there's work to be done within that, within the LGBT community, for people to acknowledge that sexual violence can happen to them and it's not their fault.
Absolutely. And I think the underreporting, especially as it relates to sexual assault, is probably the case in the non-LGBT community as well, right?
Absolutely.
I think that's just an artifact of our culture where sex and sexual mores are so tightly controlled and regulated, and you know, the guilt and shame thing that I mentioned earlier.
Sure.
But so I think that's probably prevalent throughout society, at least in you know, our culture.
Absolutely. Anyway. Well, I mean, even looking at the Maryville case that's going on right now, there's a brave young girl who's reported, and she's immediately victim blamed and shamed for being the victim of a crime that was not her fault.
Yes.
That still, I mean, that sends a message to everyone that
that's
it's
terrible.
Not safe. You know, it's not safe to report, and if they think that happens to you, keep it quiet because nobody's going to help you. I mean, that's what that message is sent to her and the community, and that's terrible.
Yes, it is. Now, you know, you mentioned when you were kind of talking through the mission of your organization, what I got out of it is basically there's like two legs. One is advocacy, maybe three, I guess. One is advocacy, one is education, and then the other is obviously support for victims.
Sure.
The advocacy leg, what do you advocate for? Is that local? Is that statewide? And do you tie in with a national organization from an advocacy perspective?
Yeah.
How does that work?
We certainly do. We're connected to several coalitions, both here locally within the state that we're part of. We're helping to form an LGBT police task force. We received a grant that enables us to try to bridge the relationship between LGBT people and the police community. And so we're hoping that work has started this year and will hopefully be more in the community doing that work, you know, kind of going forward. So that's some of that advocacy there. We also are part of the battered women's movement because we do sexual and domestic violence work. And so there's a coalition both in Missouri and Kansas that we're very involved with that does a lot of policy work around definitions to make, and why we're involved in that is to make sure that definitions of rape and sexual assault and domestic violence are LGBT inclusive. It was just the last couple of years that Kansas redefined rape, that it was not just between a man and a woman. So because we know that rape happens in other in same-sex relationships, we know that men can be raped, straight men, you know, as well as gay men. And so we're trying to be involved in that policy work and really advocating for the change on that level has been really important. And one really great thing about the domestic violence and sexual violence world is they've come a long way as far as accepting LGBT people, and especially in the last several years. And then nationally, some work that has happened that's an effect of all that local work is the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act, which is kind of the major funding source for most domestic and violence, domestic and sexual violence organizations throughout the nation. And there's even an international vow as well. And this year, it was supposed to pass in 2012, but because it is an act of Congress, it does have to be reauthorized by, Congress every 5 years. And this time we wanted an LGBT inclusive component of that said, anybody receiving this money cannot discriminate on sexual orientation or gender expression or identity. And so that didn't, the conservative parties did not so much like that, and they kind of held up the bill, but it did eventually get passed at the beginning of 2013 with that LGBT inclusive thing.
Great.
And so that's pretty phenomenal because that means that there is going to be more money and more resources out there for LGBT victims of violence.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
That is really great.
Yeah.
Justin, hang on. We're going to take a real quick break for some sponsor announcements, and then we'll be right back.
This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Chris Christie surrenders in the battle for New Jersey marriage equality, Tret Fury carves herself a piece of the sky, and love looks for a way out in the dark. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
This Way Out airs 2 p.m. Saturdays, right after the 10th Voice.
And we're back with Justin Shaw. We're talking about Kansas City Anti-Violence Project, KCAVP, and the important work they do on behalf of the LGBT community in this region. Justin, you were talking a little bit about the advocacy. Tell us real quick on the education side. I know that you've been working, I think, with the Kansas City Police Department, and you mentioned the Kansas City Police Department just a little while ago, and I would be remiss if I didn't do a shout-out and a thank you to the Kansas City Police Department because they are making a serious effort. And Rebecca Castor is the LGBT liaison now. Mm-hmm. She's an officer at KCPD, and we're very proud to know her. And then the Kansas City Police Chief as well has just been remarkable, I think, compared to the last administration, don't you?
Definitely. I mean, they called us. We had been reaching out to the police department throughout the history of KCABP, trying to make some kind of relationship and try to bridge and fix that trust that has been broken for so long, and there was never any reply. And so the fact that they reached out to us, the new administration there, Commissioner Lisa Pawlowski and Chief Forte reached out to us and said, what can we do to ensure the safety of the LGBT community within Kansas City? And we said we would love an LGBT liaison. We'd love the opportunity to educate the police and the community on these things. And he said yes. There wasn't a question. A couple of months later, Rebecca was appointed, which is fantastic for us because people that might not have, some of our clients that might not have reported to police before, feel comfortable reporting to Rebecca, and we can kind of be that conduit, which is really handy. And then we've been in 2013, we've trained every single week. We will, by the end of the year, have trained every single Kansas City Police Department officer in obviously in Kansas City. And we've started out with kind of an LGBT basics, what are the definitions, what is language, as we know, us that work in activism know that people get stuck in language and definitions and not understanding that, but then also educating them on the unique circumstances of LGBT domestic and sexual violence and how when they walk into a situation that might not at first look like domestic violence, it might be domestic violence between a same-sex couple or things like that, and then hate crimes as well, and really being aware of how those happen and what, disproportionate effect of that violence has on trans people, especially trans people of color, like Monica was talking about earlier. Like all of the reports that we are involved with say exactly that thing. So we've started that, and then next year we'll be, like I said, developing a task force, hoping to do a town hall with them and really start a public dialogue about that distrust between the two communities and figure out, can we fix that, and hope that we can fix that?
That's very good. I hope we can fix that.
I do too.
It's something that we need to fix.
Yeah, we should all feel safe, especially with the people that are supposed to be making us safe. So, I think that'd be a really great social change to happen. Of course, social change takes time, as we know. So.
Correct. The intersectionality of the trans community and KCAVP, this is actually Trans Talk today, but I felt it was important to talk about KCAVP and what you do for the entire LGBT community.
Sure.
This is, after all, the 10th voice, and we do serve the entire LGBTQ community. So it's been, great hearing about all that stuff that you're doing on behalf of the community. Thank you very much. Talk a little bit about the intersectionality of the trans community, contact with you, ways that you see interacting and issues there that need to be dealt with.
Absolutely. On average, about 12% of our calls, our crisis counseling, our work is done with the transgender community. The majority of what we see with those clients is domestic violence, though if we kind of look at our bias crime numbers or our hate crime numbers, there's 30% of those victims are trans people, and of that, 20% are transgender women of color. So there's cross-section of oppression that's happening both, like Monica was talking about earlier, with race and gender identity, and then sometimes sexual orientation can play into that as well. And so all these cross-sectioning oppressions that happen that make communities more susceptible to violence. We work a lot with all gamuts of the transgender world, everywhere from survival workers to very privileged, which privileged is so weird to call any kind of LGBT person, but and just in the scope, we work very closely with that community. We do see actually our sexual assault numbers. The majority of those are transgender people reporting, which nationally is not necessarily the trend. Nationally, that's really the most underreported thing by transgender people is sexual assault. So in Kansas City, it's a little bit different. different there, but bias crimes, especially against trans women of color, is one of the highest rates of incidents that we see.
And now, that's a really interesting thing that you just said. Nationally, sexual assault is one of the least reported in the trans community, but here in the Kansas City area, it's one of the highest reported.
Sure.
So what do you attribute that to? Is it the fact that there is a welcoming organization, Kansas City Anti-Violence Project, to talk to and get help and get support? Is that why we're seeing that increased trend? Is the value of your organization the positive contributing factor there, or is it something else?
I'd like to think that we're part of that factor, but I think that I believe it takes a community, and it especially takes allies to help build that community. And within the sexual violence world, we have an amazing organization in town called MOXA, the Metropolitan Organization to Counter Sexual Assault, and they have for a very long time been very LGBT friendly and been very great about raising awareness about sexual assault. And so I think the combination of that and some of the work that's being done in other domestic and sexual violence organizations within Kansas City, I think is probably making, and then our connection with the trans community. I think that, unfortunately, we're one of the few service organizations or one of the few LGBT organizations in town that really makes a point of being very dedicated to the trans community, both as advocates, awareness, because of the disproportionate violence that happens against them. It's so important to our mission. So that being said, I think it's very, important to KCAVP and the partnerships we've made. And I think that really helps, trans people report to us a little bit more than they do maybe in other parts of the nation.
Well, obviously what you're doing is very important, and obviously the positive impact that you're having shows. So thank you. Thank you on behalf of everybody.
Sure.
Unfortunately, I believe that Brent is under the weather today. Brent, here's a shout-out to you. We were hoping he was going to be able to make it in and do the community calendar with us, but he's not able to, so we are going to do the community calendar without him. And Justin, I want you to hang on and help me with this, because some of the events that I'm going to bring up are actually the events for your organization.
Great.
And I'm gonna mention one thing real quick, and then I'm gonna let you say what month it is as well.
Awesome.
It's very important that, and I'm pulling this up on my little Android phone with this tiny screen, and I wish I had printed all of this out before I came down to the studio, so hopefully I can read this. But the first thing I want to say is that today is Intersex Awareness Day. The intersex community sometimes isn't talked about, but today is Intersex Awareness Day. And I believe it's a month, something about Violence Awareness Month,
too,
right?
It is. It's Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Everyone who works in domestic violence this month is really trying to bring a lot of awareness to the community about that, both mainstream and LGBT violence. And so we always have a fundraiser during this month. We call it a BOLA strike against violence, or striking out violence.
And that's coming up on my calendar here. It looks like November 3rd at 1 p.m. BOLA strike against violence. Where is that? What time is it?
That's going to be at Ward Parkway Lanes from 1 to 4. It's kind of be a bowl and brunch edition is what we're calling it. We're going to have a little brunch theme. And Dirty Dorothy will be there to MC, which is always a lot of fun. There'll be raffle and prizes and food. And all of that information is on our website at kcavp.org.
Great, great. So recommended donations and stuff, they can find all that information on that website, correct?
Absolutely.
Outstanding. Very good. The next thing I see on our community calendar coming up on November 5th is out former MLB player Billy Bean will be speaking at State Fair Community College. That's in Sedalia. That's at the Fred E. Davis Multipurpose Center at the St. Fair Community College. Again, that's on November 5th, and it looks like that is at 1 p.m. At 6 p.m. on November 5th, UMKC 2013 Fall Pride Lecture, Laverne Cox is going to be in town. I'm so excited about that. Laverne Cox is one of my heroes, and I'm so excited that both Laverne Cox and Janet Mock are going to be in town here in the very near future. But UMKC Pearson Auditorium, this is the UMKC 2013 Fall Pride Lecture is being hosted by the UMKC Division of Diversity and Inclusion. And Sorry, I'm trying to scroll down on my little telephone, my little phone screen here. Coming up on November 12th, Ian Harvey Superhero Best of the Fest screening at the UMKC Student Union Theater. That's presented by the UMKC LGBTQIA Programs and Services. That is a mouthful. Out Here Now, the KC LGBT Film Festival, and the Like Me Lighthouse Tuesday nights at the movies. If you want more information on that, you can certainly find information on that. It looks like possibly at the Like Me Lighthouse. It's not clear from what I can see here. On Wednesday, November 13th, Justin, I feel terrible. I'm trying to do this without having a printout and seeing this on my screen. On November 13th, Margaret Cho Live will be in town. That's really exciting. I love Margaret Cho. She's absolutely hilarious. She's going to be doing a benefit concert for the Like Me Lighthouse featuring Margaret Cho and special guests Judy Gold, John Fuselgang, and Jim Short. There's going to be a special appearance by Shelley Wright. VIP tickets with reception are available. You can find more information on Facebook. Look at the, it's got an event screen. I know that on the KKFI website, on the 10th Voice page on Facebook, you can certainly find events for these particular events that I'm talking about right now. And we're getting close to running out of time, so I'm going to have to wrap up the show. My